This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Many teams of law enforcement officials are searching an area in Sibley County outside Minneapolis for the suspected shooter of Minnesota lawmakers, sources say. They have found a vehicle and personal items that may be connected. ABC's Rachel Scott today asked President Trump if he planned to phone Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz about the shootings.
The president said, quote, it's a terrible thing. I think he's a terrible governor. I think he is a grossly incompetent person. He says, I may call him. I may call other people, too.
One person's dead, at least 11 others wounded by gunfire in a neighborhood overnight, say police in Elkhart, Indiana. They say several people fired weapons. Flash flooding in Ohio County, West Virginia, leaves at least three people dead and several others are missing, say county officials. 15% of the Iranian missiles are getting through Israeli-U.S. air defenses, says Israel's ambassador to the U.S., as attacks continue. This is ABC News. More deaths and injuries are reported at Israeli and U.S.-supported food distribution points in Gaza. More info on the suspected Minnesota shooter from ABC's Faith Abube in Brooklyn Park.
Investigators say they've recovered several firearms from Bolter's vehicle, along with No Kings flyers and writings mentioning the names of the victims, some abortion providers, and other Democratic lawmakers. Sources telling ABC News law enforcement is looking into whether he may have been motivated by extreme views on abortion.
On Saturday's No Kings Day protests across the U.S., ABC's Alex Perche in Washington.
Many protests peaceful, but some erupting into chaos. Gunfire breaking out during a demonstration in Salt Lake City, Utah. Police rushing to help one victim in critical condition. Authorities taking one man into custody and saying there are no other known threats to the community. A motive under investigation.
Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
The soap scientists have found a way to incorporate Sydney Sweeney's actual bathwater into the soap. What if she doesn't smell good? I know she's beautiful.
What if it smells terrible?
What if she stinks? And no one is going to tell her that because she's Sydney Sweeney. Here's an open invitation to Sydney Sweeney. Come by the Nightlight Studios. I'll smell you and let you know if this is a good product.
Maybe drop off,
and give us a few bucks.
Yeah. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shally Pittman. Southwest Wisconsin is seeing a surge in clean energy, emerging as a hotbed for large-scale renewable projects. Proponents say they're economically benefiting the community. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
About 10% of Wisconsin's electricity is from renewable sources. The industry employs about 6,500 people and invests $15.5 million a year in property, state, and local taxes, and more than $15 million annually in land lease payments. Caden Crapp with the Wisconsin Land and Liberty Coalition says along with the economic benefits, clean energy has the potential to provide the state with autonomy.
One of the biggest benefits that including these renewable energies into the state grid can bring is that we can start becoming a net exporter by being able to create our own Wisconsin-grown energy and be able to distribute it to other states as well.
A number of proposed projects are slated for the area, including the Whitetail Energy Center, the Badger Hollow Wind Energy Center, and the Uplands Wind Project. Each is projected to generate millions of dollars annually and collectively produce hundreds of megawatts of energy to power homes and businesses across the state. Amy Seaboth Wilson with Southwest Wisconsin Technical College says the school is leading the pack in innovation. She says it offers degrees to prepare students for the rising industry. The renewable energy influx has faced some controversy, with critics saying they replace some of the state's agricultural uses. Opponents say less than 2% of Wisconsin's 14 million acres of agricultural land would be needed to reach the state's clean energy goals. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Of showers and storms rumbling across the landscape here on this Father's Day. Mostly cloudy skies, light winds with highs in the upper 70s. By the way, some of that rain could be a bit heavy. Tonight, showers and storms continue with lows in the lower 60s. Right now, it's 67.
Maggie Dawn.
At 4 o'clock, I'm joined by Matt Rothschild. We go deep on book banning in Florida. Did you read Judy Blume? Did you like it? Well, Florida kids won't be able to read it anymore. We discuss.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6. You're listening to the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, your weekly weekend review of all things related to justice and the rule of law and government in these United States of America. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, my terrific producer Greg and I are delighted, honored that you have chosen to spend some of your time on this weekend, this important weekend in the history of our nation, in conversation, in discussion with us about these important issues that do affect our lives and our livelihoods every single day here in this nation. Once again, we have got, as always, an ambitious but achievable agenda here on Amicus, a law review. Let me tell you a bit about that before launching into it and inviting, as always, your questions, your inquiries, your comments, your observations about the subject matters on our extensive syllabus. We are necessarily going to be talking once again about a recurring feature, a recurring segment that we have here on Amicus called Injunction Function. It is not simply a linguistic flourish. It is also a representation, a reflection of what our federal district and appellate courts are doing on a regular basis in connection with what are approaching about 200 different challenges to the executive orders of your president, my president. His name is Donald Trump. Once again, in this broadcast, we are going to talk about two major entries of injunctions, issuances of temporary restraining orders by federal district court judges. They are the trial judges in America in the federal courts. We're going to talk about one judge who is in the Northern District of California. His name is Charles Breyer. We're going to talk about what he did in connection with, yes, that major event, those series of events going on right now in Los Angeles, including the president's calling up of the National Guard to address what is not, in fact, an insurrection, what is not, in fact, a rebellion, which, in fact, does not require that kind of remedial response. We're going to talk with you about what Charles Breyer, U.S. District Court Judge, Northern California, did just a couple of days ago in response to what our president attempted to do there as well, will necessarily tell you what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has done, even in the past several hours related to that particular order. We'll talk about the consequences of what Judge Breyer has done, what that means today as rallies of various kinds take place, not only in Washington, D.C., but also in places, 50 states and territories throughout this union. We'll talk about the consequences for what Judge Charles Breyer has done in connection with this question about whether or not, yes, once again, our president has the authority to do what he has tried to do and accomplished, at least up to this point, what Charles Breyer has said to the president and, more importantly, to all of us about the rule of law in America. We'll talk about that at great length. And as we have done in other instances, going to dive deep into the wonderful transcendent language used by this judge to reaffirm the rule of law in America and all things right and decent under justice. We should hear all of that, and we will, this broadcast in this hour. We will necessarily talk again inside our segment on the functions of the federal courts, the district courts, the appellate courts in imposing and issuing these injunctions. Another one having to do with this other executive order among the nearly 200 that this president has issued. This one requiring proof of citizenship nationwide in voting. There is a federal district court judge. Her name is Denise Casper. And she is sitting in the District of Massachusetts. And yes, just late this past week, Judge Casper, another of these judges, entering an order saying no. You can't do this, Mr. President. It is unconstitutional. It's contrary to the express language of our Constitution that people like James Madison and George Mason wrote into our Constitution many, many, many years ago. She's also going to tell us through her words the things that she said in her order of just days ago, why it is that the president cannot, in fact, have an influence, have a direction with respect to elections nationwide. You might think that's counterintuitive. It is not. She, in fact, is invoking the basic language of our Constitution that says that the trappings of elections are handled where? They're handled not from the White House, but from the states who are responsible for administering the elections, the processes of voting, the franchise in America, the times, the circumstances of voting, regulated, decided, and implemented by local authorities, as you all well know. We'll talk with you about those two major decisions of just days ago having to do with injunctions issued by our federal district courts here in the United States of America. It has also been another busy week for the United States Supreme Court. And we've got more of that coming up, certainly in the next week. We look forward to the Supreme Court's next 2 weeks, including especially this coming Wednesday, the 18th, and then the following week, Thursday, the 26th, additional days in which the Supreme Court is going to be issuing something approaching 25, 26, 27, 28 more opinions, decisions, some big ticket items coming up in just the next couple of weeks. Of course, here on Amicus and other broadcasts of civic media, lots of attention being paid to those because they are big ticket items. They do affect dramatically the way that you live your life, that we engage with one another here in the United States of America. We'll be talking in the wake of those days, the Wednesday, the 18th, Thursday, the 26th, days in which the Supreme Court once again is going to tell us what the law is in America. And in that connection, we are going to be spending some time in this broadcast talking about what the Supreme Court said just this past week. A number of different rulings, six altogether, four of them unanimous. That's right. 9 members of our Supreme Court agreeing, imagine that, agreeing on the results in 4 different cases, 4 out of the 6. We're going to be talking about a couple of those. There's a major suit involving the victims of a mistaken raid by law enforcement on a house. Got the wrong house when entered the wrong place, whether or not the family victimized by that misconduct of law enforcement? Can they sue? The answer is yes. And that comes out of the Supreme Court just this past week, something having to do with the Federal Tort Claims Act. You're going to hear a little bit about that today, understanding more, as we often do here, about what law school is all about and what torts are. We're also going to hear about another case involving disability rights and the capacity of a teenager to sue her school for failing to abide by the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's right. Failing to provide her with basic routine accommodations to ensure that she can get an academic education in the way that every other student at her school gets that. We're trying to talk about disability rights again, a major case coming out of the Supreme Court. We'll mention those others as well. And we're also going to talk about other things coming up. The Supreme Court right now in these days, even as it is finishing up this present term, the 2024-25 term, it's also looking forward to that first Monday in October later this year when it begins the 2025-2026 term. And it's beginning to populate its docket even now. Just this past week, the Supreme Court made some decisions about some of the litigants who are seeking review in the next term coming up in this fall and into the next calendar year, seeking review of the cases from courts below. We're going to hear about the decision by a group of Supreme Court justices that are going to be hearing a challenge to an Illinois mail-in ballot initiative. Yes, that's right. Voting rights once again going to be on the agenda, on the syllabus of our United States Supreme Court. They agreed just this past week to hear that case months from now. We're not going to get a decision on that until a year from now. Already, however, populating, putting on its docket those things that it's going to be entertaining in the coming year. They're also going to be deciding cases and not deciding cases. We're going to be hearing about a decision to decline to hear about a ban on semi-automatic weapons. A decision, again, that's going to be important not only for the lower court, but also the Supreme Court deciding not to weigh in, at least not yet in the coming term, with respect to the all-important, critical, sometimes life-destructive, life-compromising issue of firearms in America. We've talked about those cases of the past, including that Bruin case that requires now that you pass muster with respect to guns in America only if you look back to the history and find some predicate, some precedent for imposing restrictions. That's the Bruin case. Supreme Court, last major issue on in that area. And also another case last term, you may recall it well, involving whether or not someone involved in domestic violence can carry a weapon, can use a weapon, can possess a weapon. The Supreme Court apparently reluctant now to weigh in again on guns, at least so far in the coming term, declining to hear a ban on semi-automatic weapons coming out of a lower court. We're also going to less necessarily hear about some matters involving Donald Trump himself. He is going to be pursuing his claim before the United States Supreme Court to dismantle, to take apart the Department of Education. You know that well. We'll talk about what he has petitioned the court to do. And then in his own private docket, you know that our president continues to be a convicted felon. You know he's got a lot of litigation pending out there in his private capacity. And we'll talk about a couple of those cases. We'll talk about what happened just this past week in an appellate court in which Donald Trump is seeking to challenge his conviction coming out of that New York state court. You recall that well, 34 counts of violations of New York law having to do with an attempt not to disclose to the American public in the 2016 election his affair with Stormy Daniels. We'll talk about what happened just this past week in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals as Donald Trump attempts to remove, believe it or not, even after being sentenced, remove that case from the state court to send it into federal court, maintaining that none of that should ever have happened. We'll talk about what the appeals court, the federal appeals court, is doing. And then we'll also talk about what another appeals court has done to shut down Donald Trump's, again, personal pursuit of this matter involving E. Jean Carroll. You recall her well. She is the one who has been successful in proving that not only Donald Trump sexually assaulted her in the 1990s, but also defamed her in a number of judgments entered by the federal courts. The matter back in the court again on an appellate petition of just this past week. We'll tell you about the success that E. Jean Carroll and her attorney have had in pushing back on Donald Trump's latest attempts to push back on the judgment, the civil judgment entered against him. It is a lot. We say that a lot on this broadcast, and it is a lot. Many, many things going on in America these days and around the world. We'll touch on some of that as well. All of that coming up here on this broadcast of Amicus Law Review. As always, soliciting and taking your phone calls, my producer Greg and I are that phone number, as you know, 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. Join us in our discussion.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a 3-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Carmelo Anthony for The Bail Project.
Bad news? You've been arrested. Good news, your innocence is proven guilty. If you can pay your bail, good news, you go home to wait your trial. If you can't, sorry, you go to jail to wait. But sure, you still presume innocent. But since you can't afford bail, you've lost your freedom. That's not right. And that's why the Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting the in-cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Being blind doesn't look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support.
Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well. Thanking you for being a part of our broadcast this weekend. There is a lot on our docket, an important day also in American history. These are the kinds of things that our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be reading about and learning about in years to come. Today, we're also going to be examining the things of the recent past, including decisions of federal district court judges, as you have heard me say repeatedly on this and other broadcasts of the broadcast stations of Civic Media. It is the federal district court judges in our country, those individual. Yes, they're appointed by a president. They're confirmed by the Senate for life. Because of that, they have the independence, regardless of where they come from, regardless of the president who appoints them. And we're seeing that throughout our nation today, to do what is right, to exact justice in their courts and to issue opinions that are premised not upon politics and not upon partisan viewpoints, but rather upon what the law is, applying the facts to the law and making certain that their articulations of their decisions are clear and unambiguous. It is in that connection that we talk now about a major, extraordinary decision issued by a federal district court judge. His name is Charles Breyer. He is in the Northern District of California. The Northern District has a number of different courthouses in places like Eureka and San Jose and Oakland, and indeed San Francisco, the Northern District of California. It is one of the 93 districts in our nation and in our territories. And that includes the work of Charles Breyer there, a district court judge who has issued what can only be regarded as an extraordinary piece of jurisprudence. 36 pages. It is long. And yes, indeed, as I always do, I'm going to assign that to you to read even over this weekend because it is an important document in our nation's history. Important to understand what is going on and what is not going on in connection with the president's decision to invoke the National Guard in California, particularly in Los Angeles. The judge on Thursday of this last week temporarily blocking the federal government's mobilization of the California National Guard to protect immigration agents from protesters in Los Angeles. At least that's the way in which this is being described. The judge ruled that the Trump administration, the White House, has illegally taken control of the state's troops and ordered them to return to taking orders from the governor. His name, as you know, Gavin Newsom. Again, amazing 36-page ruling. Charles Breyer severing Donald Trump's control of about 4,000 National Guard troops, hundreds of whom already deployed at the time of this decision of Thursday of this past week into the streets of Los Angeles on his orders. The judge, among many other things, saying that the administration's seizure of them, taking control from the governor of the National Guard, violated various procedural requirements in the federal statute that contemplates that. Specifically, he goes on to say that President Trump's actions, these are his words, not my summary of them, were illegal, both exceeding the scope of his statutory authority and violating, yes, here it is once again, the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Judge Breyer writing as well, we must therefore return control of the California National Guard to the governor of the state of California forthwith. That's what he did on Thursday. Now, it's important to note that this order directing that control be returned to the governor was intended to take effect in Friday. At noontime on Friday, the Trump administration, as it always does, and as it has a right to do, immediately filed a notice of appeal where to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the appellate court that includes California, a huge amount of geography in our nation. And the United States Court of Appeals agreed to stay, to suspend that ruling while it reviews the case, only temporarily blocking it from taking effect. It is not in effect today. And it is also noteworthy that when the president said that the Ninth Circuit came in and reversed the lower court, that is not accurate. That is not what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals did. Courts of Appeals routinely issue stays of this sort, so they've got the time to take a look at the merits of this. It is extensive, as Judge Breyer has indicated in his massive, his opus on the authorities of presidents to invoke these principles and to apply the National Guard in circumstances of dubious foundation. Justice Breyer's ruling on the National Guard went beyond what California had asked for, believe it or not. The state's lawsuit contended initially that the president's mobilization of the National Guard was illegal, but its specific notion was for a temporary restraining order. Again, as we've talked, these mechanisms for putting things in place presently to prohibit things from going forward, ordering, limiting, and military forces under federal control, only guarding federal buildings in the city and no other law enforcement tasks. Well, Judge Breyer got a hold of this, and he said, nope, I'm going to go beyond that. So that Donald Trump, you are blocked from using California's National Guard at all. He also ever rejected a request by the state and by the governor, again, his name is Newsom, as you know, to restrain a separate group, you've heard about these folks as well, of active duty Marines there, which the administration has also mobilized to counter the protests. Judge Breyer said it would be inappropriate to issue any other order restricting the Marines' actions when they have not done anything yet, anyway, that would violate something called the Posse Comitatus Act. There's a lot going on here, is there not? You probably know, you may know from your history, from your civics course, that that's the law that very generally makes it illegal to use federal troops for law enforcement on domestic soil. He said that the state would need to return within a week to turn his temporary restraining order into a longer-lasting injunction, and that will almost certainly happen going ahead. Let us, however, spend some time talking about the language that the judge has used in imposing his order, now stayed for a while, but nonetheless a compelling piece of litigation history going forward here. We're going to talk more about exactly what the judge has said in connection with process and also substance about what a rebellion is when Amicus, a law review, continues.
Eagle 1490 AM. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Siebertson. Many teams of law enforcement officials are searching an area in Sibley County outside Minneapolis for the suspected shooter of Minnesota lawmakers. Sources say they have found a vehicle and personal items that may be connected. ABC's Rachel Scott today asked President Trump if he planned to phone Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz about the shootings.
The president said, quote, "It's a terrible thing. I think he's a terrible governor. I think he is a grossly incompetent person." He says, "I may call him. I may call other people, too."
One person's dead, at least 11 others wounded by gunfire in a neighborhood overnight, say police in Elkhart, Indiana. They say several people fired weapons. Flash flooding in Ohio County, West Virginia, leaves at least three people dead and several others are missing, say county officials. 15% of the Iranian missiles are getting through Israeli-U.S. air defenses, says Israel's ambassador to the U.S. as attacks continue. This is ABC News.
The Brewers and the Cardinals wrap it up. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers' four-game series at home against the St. Louis Cardinals concludes today. We'll have a recap tonight. Cardinals won last night, 8-5. Things got a little testy between the two teams. 40,000 fans watched as the Brewers' Caleb Durbin ran to first base, now played by the Cardinals' Wilson Contreras. He's the brother of the Brewers' catcher, William. It appeared that Wilson blocked the bag, and some of the Brewers, including Rhys Hoskins, shouted some complaints about the play from the dugout. After the game, Wilson Contreras told St. Louis reporters, "Well, he said some things about the Brewers I can't repeat." Oh, by the way, Hoskins got beaned by a pitch in that game. It got spicy. Manager Pat Murphy.
Well, it's Cardinals Brewers, man. There's always going to be high emotion. The players handle that stuff, you know, like that's the way it goes. We're not looking to fight, but we're not going to be pushed around either.
So the Brewers have tomorrow off before heading to Chicago for a three-game series against the first-place Cubs. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Alan Ritchson has played Reacher for three seasons now, and season four is currently in production. It's a good gig because there are 29 Reacher books, and each one equals one TV season, which could keep an actor working for quite a while. The role is iconic and based on the books by Lee Child. Ritchson says when he won the role, he was nervous about trying to fill the shoes of Tom Cruise, who played the character in the movies. Ritchson says he was really thrilled when he got the part, but recently said that he was even more excited when he realized the character Reacher in the book eventually has thinning hair. Richson says he erupted in cheers when he read that because there is no pressure now to not go bald, which for a guy can be a challenge over the course of 29 TV seasons. Great show. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Your news.
news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some showers and storms rumbling across the landscape here on this Father's Day. Mostly cloudy skies, light winds with highs in the upper 70s. By the way, some of that rain could be a bit heavy. Tonight, showers and storms continue with lows in the lower 60s. Right now, it's 67.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In discussions over the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, backed by Donald Trump, that's making its way through Congress, none other than Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has emerged as the most prominent Republican critic of the bill, saying at a recent Milwaukee Press Club event that it is, quote, not even close to adequate. Johnson has said he wants spending cuts to go even further, including making cuts to Medicaid. But Johnson's position as a critic of this bill makes him especially influential in these negotiations. But let's not forget the last time he was in a similar position. In 2017, he was a critic of the Trump tax cut bill, but what he fought for was a tax break for certain types of businesses, perhaps not coincidentally, businesses owned by his largest donors, Dick and Liz Uihlein. In 2018 alone, the Uihleins received more than $200 million in tax breaks because of this bill. So as the Big Beautiful Bill is negotiated in the Senate, let's not forget this piece of recent history.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation area. Jay Matt Nair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we will recap all the news from over the weekend and wrap it up with audio sorbet and This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour as well. As always, my producer Greg and I are soliciting, encouraging your questions, your inquiries, your comments, your observations about all these many things on our syllabus this day, this weekend, here on Amicus Law Review, talking right now about this major decision, this major injunctive decision issued by Federal District Court Judge Charles Breyer, Northern California, telling the president that he does not have the authority, he's not done this properly, to nationalize, to bring in the National Guard over the objection of the governor there in Los Angeles and other places. The opinion, as always, is readable. It is accessible. This is a judge doing his job, as we have seen with other federal district court judges and appeals court judges as well. The order stayed for now by the Ninth Circuit, the slightly higher court, but only for the purpose of giving that court a chance to review the merits and demerits of the positions that are articulated by the federal district court judge. What does this judge tell us? Some excerpts. It is important to understand. It is important to digest what it is that the court has said and not just read the headlines in these important matters. He spends a lot of time. He reviews the history, all of that much in the news. That is with respect to the activities, the protests going on in California, other places around the country, to be sure, but specifically there. He talks about the communications, the lack of communication between the federal government and the governor about what needs to happen here. The statements made by the governor, and yes, indeed, the mayor of Los Angeles, indicating that local law enforcement can, in fact, as they have been trained to do and have done in the past, can handle all of this. That the National Guard does not need to be mobilized upon a presidential order, in large part because there's no rebellion there. There is no insurrection there. We'll get to that along the way. A lot of things that the judge teaches us, teaches me, teaches you about the law in America. He begins by noting exactly what it is that the president has done. He says that the president intervened in this matter, these matters involving protests, again, principally related, again, to immigration issues and deportations. The judge notes that along the way. That's the subject matter. It's gone far beyond that, of course, but notes that the president, President Trump, intervene in response to these protests in the evening of June 7th, and specifically issuing some memorandums to his Secretary of Defense and the Attorney General, Secretary of Homeland Security, and finding that numerous incidents of violence and disorder have recently occurred and threatened to continue in response to the enforcement of federal law by ICE and other United States government personnel. That's his finding by the president to support what he said next. He said, to the extent that protests or acts of violence directly inhibit the execution of the laws, no evidence for that. But he goes on to say they constitute, here we go, a form of rebellion against the authority of the government of the United States. And that's the predicate. That's the reason why this has proceeded. The memo explains that due to these incidents and credible threats of continued violence, President calling into federal service members and units of the National Guard under a statute. And here is the number you're going to be hearing a lot about. It's 10 United States Code. Here is the number, 12406. 12406, perhaps it's going to become a chant of some kind, because it is the statute that proscribes the ways in which the president cannot do these kinds of things. It establishes the mechanisms for his doing it under appropriate circumstances. It prescribes some of those. And the judge says that you have not followed 12406, even though you have invoked it here in this situation. Defendants, the judge notes, the defendants, of course, being the president and the other members of the cabinet, did not notify Governor Newsom of their intent to federalize the California National Guard prior to the issuance of that memorandum. And that's a huge issue, because one of the findings of the district court judge, we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, is a violation of procedure. In order to do this, in order to invoke the notion that there is a rebellion, you need to notify the governor of the state that you're going to do it, basically to solicit the opinion of that governor to determine if there are less intrusive and invasive mechanisms for doing this. That's what the law contemplates. That's what my president, your president, failed to do. And that's the reason why, among other things, the judge in his extensive order says you failed to follow the law, the rules, how this is done. If you had done it properly, maybe there could have been a different result here. But you didn't do that. The Administrative Procedures Act, Mr. President, prescribes this, and you didn't do it. And because of that, your actions fail. The court order from a District Court Judge Charles Breyer goes on describing the procedural history, noting that this particular challenge is not only under those Administrative Procedures Act provisions, but also a little additional civics here. Violation of the 10th Amendment. Once again, we've talked about that in another setting, having to do with the reservation to the states of those things not expressly set forth in the Constitution. You know that because you're students of the Constitution. And here's another new word for you. We've got a number for you today, and we also have a new phrase for you today, ultra vires, or ultra vires, depending upon how you want to pronounce the Latin. Ultra vires, it's an allegation that the defendant, the target of your lawsuit, has engaged in conduct beyond their authority. Ultra vires. And the people who are bringing this lawsuit, basically the governor of the state of California, Gavin Newsom, and the lawyers there, are alleging that the president is acting ultra vires, V-I-R-E-S, because he's failing to stay in his lane, basically doing something that he has no authority to do. And, oh, by the way, also violating the 10th Amendment in intruding into the state area, also proscribed by the Constitution, and violating the Administrative Procedures Act. What is some of the language? What is some of the language that the judges use to justify findings under all of that, that indeed there is something gone very wrong here? He says again that under 12406, that's the number once again, a president can call into federal service the National Guard, but only if the United States or its Commonwealth is invaded or is in danger of invasion by a foreign nation, whether there is a rebellion or danger of a rebellion against the authority of the government, or the president is somehow unable to invoke his powers with regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. He goes into great detail in the following 20 pages or so to explain how none of those is satisfied here. There has not been an invasion. There has not been a rebellion. And indeed, the president does have many authorities that he can exercise, not including this. Talks about a thing called the political question doctrine and notes that this is not a political issue. This is not one of those things, even though, yes, it is much in the political discussion of our nation this weekend and beyond. This is not the kind of thing that courts can walk away from. The political question doctrine does not prohibit courts from entering into all of this. And because of that, he then goes into the core of his decision, and that is all about this concept that somehow we have afoot in the United States of America a rebellion. And indeed, pages 17 and 18 and 19 and 20 of his order, he goes to where all of us would go. He goes to a dictionary, right? He goes to Black's Law Dictionary and says that rebellion, from the current edition of it, it's an open, organized, armed resistance to an established government or ruler, an organized attempt to change the government or leader of a country through violence, open resistance, opposition to authority or tradition. And goes on, rebellion under Black's Law Dictionary, deliberate organized resistance by force and arms to the laws and operation of the government committed by a subject. This goes on. The Cyclopedia Dictionary of Law, also describing rebellion. The American Dictionary of the English Language, describing rebellion in the same ways, and finding in the end that rebellion is defined in our language and also legally. He says that in order for there to be a rebellion, first, it must not only be violent, but also be armed. Second, it has to be organized. And third, a rebellion must be open and avowed. Fourth, a rebellion must be against the government as a whole, often with an aim of overthrowing the government rather than in opposition to a single law or issue. And that's the key. That's the key, right? The protests in Los Angeles, he goes on to find, fall far short of rebellion. Defendants, again, in these cases, in this matter, that's the president and the other members of the cabinet, talk about violent rioters and mobs. And so the court pauses to state, he says, that it can be no debate that most protesters here have demonstrated peacefully. Goes on to say, violence is necessary for a rebellion, but it is not sufficient. Goes on to say that even accepting the questionable premise that people armed with fireworks and rocks and concrete and chairs and bottles of liquid are armed, the court, this is the judge speaking and talking, is aware of no evidence in the record of actual firearms. Nothing in the record before him to this time. Some presumably engage violently with officers at close quarters in the daylight, while many others threw items under cover of darkness, he finds, protected by a crowd and identities concealed. He says all of that has happened. That's in the record. Certainly the peaceful protesters, he says, were indeed organized to some degree, and that people knew generally what they were doing and the subject matter that they're going to participate in, that is these deportations. That's the single law or issue. Goes on to say, but there is no evidence of organized as apart from sporadic or impromptu violence, nor is there evidence that any of the violent protesters were attempting to overthrow the government as a whole. And that's the key. That's the key to all of this. He says the evidence is overwhelming that protesters gathered to protest a single issue, the immigration raids. And while defendants, again, the president and the others, have pointed to several instances of violence, they have not identified a violent, armed, organized, open, and avowed uprising against the government as a whole. The definition, he says, of a rebellion is unmet. And for that reason, he goes on to speak in words that are transcendent. And here we are. This is the language in which the judge talks about the vacuousness of the president's decision to send in the National Guard, to invoke the National Guard there in California in circumstances where there is not indeed a rebellion. He says this, it is worth consuming this. This is Judge Charles Breyer just days ago. Moreover, the court is troubled by the implication inherent in the defendants, that's the president's argument, that protest against the federal government, a core civil liberty protected by the First Amendment, can justify a finding of rebellion. That's the judge speaking. He said reports of history are chock full of government, even when are chock full of language, explaining the importance of individuals' right to speak out against the government, even when doing so is uncomfortable. Even when doing so is provocative, even when doing so causes inconvenience. He is articulating there the core fundamental purposes and focuses of, yes, indeed, the First Amendment. He says, to many, the immediate consequence of this freedom may often appear to be only verbal tumult, discord, and even offensive utterance. That the air may at times seem filled with verbal cacophony is, in this sense, not a sign of weakness, but rather a sign of strength. In our system, undifferentiated fear or apprehension of disturbance is not enough to overcome the right to freedom of expression. Any departure from absolute regimentation may cause trouble. Any word spoken, he says, that deviates from the views of another person may start an argument or cause a disturbance. But our Constitution says we must take that risk. And that is the point. No rebellion, and the First Amendment protects this conduct. An important lesson.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
No more mold, no more damage, no more slipping and hurting. Make your ordinary bathroom extraordinary for only $99 per month. New shower, new door, new tub, new wall, new anti-slip technology. BCI Bath and Shower is made in America for the highest quality. First 50 callers save $1,500 on a Never-Clear glass treated door. BCI Bath and Shower, interest-free financing options. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. Tarrant County, Texas County Commissioners approved a new county redistricting map June 3rd, diluting the votes of Black and Hispanic voters. But commissioners claim the gerrymandering was for political, not racial reasons. The map likely eliminates a majority-minority district and has drawn widespread condemnation and a Voting Rights Act lawsuit. County Commissioners and Senior County Official Judge Tim O'Hare brought in the Conservative Public Interest Legal Foundation and the National Republican Redistricting Trust to draw the map, according to reporting by Democracy Docket. Their efforts apparently manipulated the districts to gain another GOP County Commission seat and a 4-to-1 advantage. Analysis by the UCLA Voting Rights Project and Southern Methodist University found the approved map packed District 2 Black and Hispanic voters into District 1, reducing the chance a Black or Hispanic candidate would be elected in District 2. Because the county staggers election cycles for different districts, it also disenfranchised as many as 150,000 voters, heavily Black and Hispanic, who can't vote in their current district's 2026 election and must wait until 2028. Voters sued under the VRA and the 14th and 15th Amendments. The commissioners claimed that they gerrymandered for political advantage, to which the Supreme Court turns a blind eye, and not racial discrimination. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Time for the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Warm weather is finally here, and so is wildfire smoke from Canada. Forecasters say we can expect air quality warnings to come and go and come again with no end in sight as fires blaze out of control across central and western Canada. Environmental advocates say the hazardous smoke blanketing our state just when we want to head outdoors shows no community is safe from the impacts of climate change and should be a wake-up call for policymakers. The EPA is pushing to end its popular Energy Star program that has helped families identify energy-efficient appliances and home energy upgrades for more than 30 years. A group of U.S. senators, including Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, is calling on the EPA to keep the popular program, saying for every dollar spent on Energy Star, Americans get $350 in savings. Knowledge is power. For a deep dive into Wisconsin's most pressing environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking all about this major decision issued by Federal District Court Judge Charles Breyer, Northern California, finding that, in fact, the president has acted illegally in violation of federal statute, in violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, acting ultra vires, once again, beyond the scope of his assigned responsibilities in this magnum opus, 36 pages of decision from the judge. It is worth reading, including this language that takes special meaning this weekend and today as Americans gather around our nation, all 50 states and territories, to engage in their First Amendment rights to protest, to articulate their views. The judge saying once again that we are a nation of laws, and one of those is the Constitution, the First Amendment, guaranteeing that indeed people have the right to speak out, even if that freedom includes verbal tumult and discord and even offensive utterance, that the air may at times seemingly be filled with verbal cacophony is in this sense not a sign of weakness, but of strength. That's from the federal district court judge. He goes on to talk about other issues related to the balancing of harms here. It is significant to note that he invokes prior precedent in a case called Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer. A fellow named Justice Jackson, a very long time ago, talked about the threats to the society and the community. And in the end, invoking that, Judge Breyer says this. He says that federal agents and property may actually be well served by the demilitarization of and a concurring de-escalation of this situation. Comes in the wake of his analysis of all of these legal issues, including the merits of the petition and the balancing of harms here. And then he goes on to say this. Regardless, plaintiffs and the citizens of Los Angeles face a greater harm from the continued unlawful militarization of their city, which not only inflames tensions with protesters, threatening increased hostilities and loss of life, but also deprives the state for 2 months of its own use of thousands of National Guard members to do what? To fight fires, combat the fentanyl trade, and perform other critical functions. As discussed above, the defendant's actions also threaten to chill legitimate First Amendment expression. Accordingly, the judge finds, the court concludes that the plaintiff, and yes, indeed, that is the governor of the state of California and others affiliated with him, have demonstrated the balance of equities tips in their favor, and that an injunction restraining the president's use of military force in Los Angeles is indeed in the public interest. 36 pages of that. That's a sampling of the language from Judge Breyer of just late this past week. It stands as a major position statement, not only on the merits of this particular invocation, talks about what a rebellion is, talks about the alternative means, the capacity, yes, indeed, of the president to engage in those things to which he is assigned, the execution of laws, to take care that the laws of our country be faithfully executed, and indicating that none of those standards supports what the president is doing here. It is a very important order, stayed for a while and not in effect today because of the actions of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, staying that, suspending it, while they can take a look not only at 36 pages of an order, but also the underlying predicates, the things that the judge has summarized so very well. He is writing to the Ninth Circuit. He plainly is envisioning that the Ninth Circuit is going to be reviewing every last dot, every last cross T, every single statement that he makes. It is precise, it is exacting, and it is transcendent language. More importantly, on this day, on this weekend, he is also writing to America. He is telling us what a president can and cannot do. He is telling us in a time of tumult what the First Amendment means, what it doesn't mean, and he's telling us when a rebellion exists and when it does not. We are not in rebellion. We are presently in a time of heightened discourse. And as the judge says, that is the beauty of our system. We appreciate as well here on Amicus, a Law Review, callers and texters. We appreciate that tremendously because you add to the conversation. Greg from Waukesha, you've been waiting online for a while. Greg, delighted to have you with me in this important discussion this weekend.
Yes, Jim, thank you. And I always an honor to talk to you. I'll be brief because I know you're against the top of the hour break. But I've often wanted to teach an art class at Carroll University, my alma mater, on protest and what it is, because it is a right we do have, Jim, related to the First Amendment. It is our First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And what I want to say is this is a total overreach by President Trump, as among with all his overreaches, to bring in the National Guard. It seems like all protests now are met with opposition from the police, the National Guard, you know, and we do need to respect our authorities, but we can do that in a peaceful way. And I'm glad this judge, you know, stayed this order, basically. Love your show, Jim. Thank you very much.
Greg, appreciate so very much those comments. Could not have said it better. When one day you become a federal judge, Greg, you too should write those kinds of things into your orders. They are parallel with what Judge Breyer has said about the importance of the First Amendment. It does have limitations, as we have talked before. You can't do all kinds of things that would upset the normal operation of many things. But those limitations, those restrictions on it are limited in these circumstances. The right to protest and to say things that are popular and unpopular, that's your point. That's the judge's point as well. That's what we exalt today, not only in this order, not only in California, but in Wisconsin and in states around our nation. An important decision coming out of a district court and also from the appeals court at some point soon. When Amicus Law Review comes back, we're going to talk about another decision by another judge in Massachusetts just this past week, also related to the rule of law. Stay with us for that discussion.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. President Trump rejected an Israeli plan in recent days to kill Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, say two U.S. officials to ABC News. When asked about the story, first reported by Reuters, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu would not say anything about it. More air attacks between Israel and Iran for a third day. 15% of the Iranian missiles are getting through Israeli-U.S. air defenses, says Israeli's ambassador to the U.S. Reaction from retired U.S. General Joseph Votel.
Iran is counting on that and hoping that will put pressure on the Israeli administration to stop doing what they're doing.
Law enforcement officers searching an area in Sibley County outside Minneapolis for the suspected shooter of Minnesota lawmakers. Sources say they found a vehicle and personal items that may be connected. One person's dead, at least 11 others wounded by gunfire in a neighborhood overnight, say police in Elkhart, Indiana. This is ABC News. The jury